So today we continue, I think that's the third lecture on gauge theory. So I'm going now to show how one performs the operation of gauge fixing, which is something which has to be done when quantizing gauge theories, especially by functional integral methods. So the idea of why we need gauge fixing, the principle of gauge invariance and gauge fixing is exactly the same for non-abelian gauge theories like the SU2 gauge theories that we are considering than for the Maxwell theory. That's the same basic reason. But there are technical, or you know, both technical and conceptual difference for non-abelian gauge theories linked to the fact precisely that the theory is non-abelian and therefore gauge fixing is more complicated but also more interesting. So I'm going to explain why gauge fixing. Fixing in a functional integral. And I'm going to show that this gauge fixing makes a new appearance of a new term in the functional integral for non-abelian gauge theory, which is called the Fadeyev-Popov determinant. Or in fact, it's a procedure which has been due both to Feynman. It has been developed in the US in the 60s by Feynman, by Bryce DeWitt, a famous theoretical physicist who worked a lot in quantum gravity, one of the founders, and by Fadeyev. I never remember how many D's, and Popov in Russia independently. Okay. And in particular, I'm going to show how, so this leads to the famous Fadeyev-Popov determinant, which is going to be a functional determinant. And then I'm going to show how this determinant can be represented using anti-commuting variables, so the famous Fadeyev-Popov ghosts fields, which makes calculation of perturbation theory very simple, but also reveals some conceptual aspects of gauge theories that I might say a word probably next day. Okay, so let's go back to what we did last week. We were considering a gauge theory involving a non-abelian gauge group, which in our case was just a group SU2 for simplicity, also for importance, but it goes for any general Lie group. Okay, and of course we had also in mind that the U1 Maxwell theory is also amenable to what we did. Okay. So for the SU2, so I'm going just to consider pure gauge theory. So no coupling to fermions or to matter fields to discuss gauge fixing, but they can be incorporated easily afterwards. Okay. So for SU2, remember, we have a symmetry group, gauge symmetry group, which has three generators, three currents. So there are three different vector potentials. So we have gauge fields. We have a gauge field, which is a gauge potential, which is not a mu. That's a spin. It's the analog. But now this is a 2x2 matrix. Well, it can be. There are three components, so it can be written as a mu a t a, where these are the generators, and a goes from 1 to 3. Those are the indices, number of components of A in the fundamental representation. Okay? So A lives in the fundamental representation of the group. It's a 2x2 matrix. Written in this way, 2x2 matrix. If you represent the TA as 1/2 sigma A, where this has a poly matrix. Okay, so these are the gauge field, and we have the gauge transformation. Gauge transformation are defined by having an element of the group associated to each point of space-time. So we have the generator G, which is something like function G of X, where each G is a matrix of SU2. Okay. So it's the analog of the exponential I alpha X in U1 theory. Okay. For SU1, G will be an element of U1, so it will be just a complex phase. Okay. And of course, here we just have matter fields, so we have the gauge potentials, and therefore, gauge transformation acts on A. And last week, we discussed mainly infinitesimal transformation. So we discussed what's happening when G of X is 1, the matrix 1, plus I alpha of X, where alpha of X is an element of the fundamental representation. Alpha belongs to the fundamental representation. Okay, but that's just because G of X can be written as the exponential of I alpha. It's a general form. And so we discussed what is a gauge transformation on AMU. And we saw that AMU, if you apply an infinitesimal gauge transformation, AMU goes to AMU of alpha plus something which is called d mu alpha of x plus I minus I times the commutator of a mu of x and alpha of x. That's a mu and alpha, which is, that's the term what's come. And, but you may also consider what's happening when you make a non-infinitesimal gauge transformation. And in this case, a mu, I'm going to write it in a short way without the x's. That's a mu of x. That's a mu of x, of course. A mu goes to something that I'm going to call him ag of mu, which is equal to g times a mu plus. Yeah, there is a plus. The ordinary derivative applied to g minus 1. So it's a short way to write that a mu of x is g of x times a mu of x times g minus 1 of x plus the ordinary derivative of times g of x times the ordinary derivative of the matrix inverse, g minus 1. Okay? And you can check that if you write that g is of this form, you recover this. So that's a non-infinitesimal gauge transformation. And I think I spotted there is a typo in the lecture notes. There is a high factor here, which shouldn't be there. So this is a plus. Okay. And of course, this object, d mu alpha minus I a mu of x alpha of x, can be rewritten in terms of covariant derivatives. So this can be rewritten as a mu of x plus, a mu of x plus the covariant derivative, which depend on alpha, of alpha of x. Covariant derivative. And the covariant derivative here is just the ordinary derivative, like in Maxwell's theory, plus a commutator, which comes from the fact that we have a non-abelian gauge series. Okay. Okay. But that's another, if you want, you can view this as another nice interpretation of what a covariant derivative is. Okay. Acting on some field. Okay. So that's what we had. And I think that's all. Okay. And now, of course, for doing classical gauge theory, that's all what we need. Provided, and we have an action. So we have an action, which as we have seen, is S of A is minus 1 over 2 g squared, integral over space-time, of trace of f mu nu over x,
fu nu of x.
That's an action with a field strength. Fu nu of x equal, and I just have to check my formula, otherwise I will make mistakes. This is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, the usual term of Maxwell's theory, minus I, the commutator of a mu a nu. Okay. That's the field strength. And this is covariant under gauge transformation, and this is invariant under local gauge transformation, exactly like in QED. Okay, so we have an action, we have a field strength, we have the definition of the fields, we have a gauge transformation, so it should be okay. Okay, so, and well, I may remind also you that why is gauge invariance important? That's because the physical field are AMU, the electric field E and B. AMU is a convenient way to see the invariance property of the theory, but it is redundant in the fact that different AMU, precisely AMU obtained by some local gauge transformation, describe the same physics, exactly like in electrodynamics. So gauge invariance is here to make the theory consistent, invariant under Lorentz and the Poincaré group. And in the quantum theory, it's here to make the theory consistent and unitary. We'll come back to that a bit later. Okay. So in particular, in a classical series, gauge invariance ensures that the electromagnetic waves just have transverse polarization, and that's the electromagnetic wave travels at the speed of light. That's essential. Gauge invariance does the job, I think. Okay, so now the question is, how do we do functional integral? So functional integral. Integral, so according to Mann, so on. What do you do? Okay, if I believe in the principle of Feynman of functional integral, which works very well for bosonic fields, it works, we have seen also, for Dirac fields. Once you have defined this procedure of functional integral of an anti-commuting field, well, you can say I can define a functional integral which is of this form. Integral d of a exponential minus, so I'm going to work in the, I can work in the Minkowskian setting, where here you have some h mu nu, which are the raising and the lowering of indices is made according to the tensor of spacetime with signature minus plus plus plus. You can say, okay, let's just do this. And as usual, you define the action as an action for x, and I can define a measure as formally as products over x, products over mu. Remember that the mu has some ta, so products over a of da mu a of x. Okay, so a goes from 1 to 3. Mu goes to, well, if you want, 0 to 3, because, and x is a sum of all points in space-time. Okay. Well, principle, this should do the job. And according to that, we should be able to compute, you know, expectation value of operators which correspond to correlation functions in the quantum theory. Okay. However, and in fact, the problem is already there in quantum electrodynamics. So in the U1 theory, you have this gauge invariance. So gauge invariance means that if you, the action of a gauge transform field, I'm writing in a compact form A of G as according to this thing. But the collection of A mu, okay, is Fs of A. Therefore, you have many, many configuration, many gauge field configuration in the space of all A, which gives exactly the same action. So you are doing a huge overcounting. That's not surprising. That's what gauge invariance is. So there is a huge overcounting. You must integrate, you consider that the fact that we integrate over all gauge transformation hidden in this integral is an integral over all gauge transformation. Okay. And that might or might not be a problem, but that's going to be a problem when we are going to do perturbation theory. As we remember on Friday, I wrote in a schematic way the perturbation rules that follows from this action. So we have gluons interacting. And when you do perturbation theory, it means that you expand around the classical solution of the vacuum. So pass integral. And it means that when you make perturbation, all perturbations that amount to make a gauge transformation are flat direction. And so the propagator, which is the inverse of the second derivative of the action, doesn't exist because it's not invertible in this direction. So that's, to deal with this, that's what the gauge fixing procedure is. The question is choose a set of AMU which where this gauge invariance is degeneracy is fixed. Okay. See the procedure. Why did I write? And so I think you have seen that already in QFT1 and maybe in the course on quantum electrodynamics in classical physics. Picture can be written. First, let me just give a few examples of gauge fixing. Those are the gauge fixing procedure that you use, for instance, in just doing classical electrodynamics. One is the Coulomb gauge. Remember that can be written as a vector Coulomb potential and vector potential if you separate time and space. Okay. So the Coulomb gauge means that you assume that the gradient of A is zero. So the magnetic potential is divergence free. You have the axial gauge. Well, you can write this as A0. That's the first component. A0, of course, corresponds to the Coulomb potential. The axial gauge means that A0 equals zero. So you assume that you have no Coulomb potential. It doesn't mean that there is no electric field, because the electric field as a term that comes from the time derivative of A. So it's a Coulomb gauge is not a very good gauge to do electrostatics, but it's a good gauge to do to study interaction between currents. Okay. And you have, if you are interested in relativistic electromagnetism, the Lorentz gauge. Name are associated to this are Landau and Feynman, which is that you take d mu of a mu equals zero. So this one is clearly relativistic invariant. It means that d over dt of a zero plus divergence of a equals zero. So that's good for relativistic invariant. That's the one we are going to use. But you can imagine some other ones. Some other gauge are convenient for some, depending on the problem. Okay, so now once you have this gauge fixing procedure, what does it mean to introduce a gauge fixing procedure in a functional integral? So let me introduce the diagram, the picture that is in the lecture notes. We are going to consider a big space A. I'm going to call it big calligraphic A, which is a space of all configuration A mu of x. A of x. So it's a space of all space. This is a space of space-time gauge field configuration. Okay, so it's very abstract, but it's the analog of the space of field configuration in a quantization of the bosonic scalar field, and it's analog to the space of histories of a trajectories of a particle in ordinary Feynman integrals for relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay. And since gauge transformation, you see, are given by arbitrary function of g of x, I'm going to use the following notation, which is that I'm going to call capital G. So how is the G? Something like that. This is a space of space-time gauge transformation. It's a space of function from M4 into the gauge group G, called SU in our case. And I don't specify whether these functions are continuous, differentiable, smooth. That's very abstract, but mathematicians can make this precise. Physicists. Okay. So now, in this functional integral, we are integrating over the big space A. In fact, I decide that I integrate over this space A. So I have my space. I have this very big space, what that means, this space A. Okay. So a point in the space represents a gauge field configuration. It's an A. So this is an A. Here, when I write an A, this is a point in this big calligraphic A space. Okay. Now, gauge transformation acts in this space, of course. And if you perform a gauge transformation, you map the gauge transformation into another gauge configuration into another equivalent gauge potential configuration. Which he says that just that G acts on A. It's the action of a group on an ensemble. And G acts by map A into A of G. Okay. So you may consider what is the sets of all gauge field configuration equivalent to A, some A. You may consider what is called the orbit of A. The orbit of G, which is a set of, so an orbit of G is a set of all the AG for all G belonging to the big group for a given A. This is called the orbit of a group. So this is an orbit. So an orbit is just the space of gauge equivalent configuration of the potential. So an orbit is just a physical configuration. Yes?
Where does the transformation rule for the connection A come from?
How does the transformation?
Where does the transformation rule for A come from?
Where is?
Where does it come from?
What's it comes from this. It's given there. Is it? That's I define. Well, the transformer I didn't define, I didn't choose it. That's how it is defined. And it comes from, that's the generalization of what is done in electromagnetism. So, well.
Is there is there the rule that you wrote above that just comes from electromagnetism? Or
it comes from?
You're saying it just comes from electromagnetism, or is there because I haven't seen something like this in electromagnetism. The one that you wrote above.
This one?
Yeah.
It's written on page
823. But I didn't know how does it, why does AG transform like that? So that's why I was asking.
It's just because it's, do you admit this?
Yeah.
You just exponential it. You just exponential. See, instead of writing G of X as 1 plus I alpha of X, you write G of X as exponential I alpha of X, which of course is 1 plus I alpha of X, and then plus ta 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 ta. You have commutators. And they continue. Use Campbell-Hausdorff, you end up with this.
I'm asking about the one that's written in the box. Does it come, you don't assume a form which?
Well, it's the definition of a gauge transformation. Take it as a definition, and this is a particle.
Yeah.
This is a particle case, but both are equivalent. Okay.
I think maybe it makes sense if you were to write down you started by writing down a two-component complex field variable.
Yes.
And under each transformation, that would make the kinetic term invariant under each transformation.
So, yes, so you would like me to write it in terms of component of the matrix?
I'm saying that maybe it makes more sense, because she was asking where it comes from, so it has to be of that form in order for the action to be gauge invariant, right?
Yes, yes. It has to be in this form in order for the action to be gauge invariant, but it has to be this form so that the currents couple to the gauge field. So this is the definition of a gauge transformation. This is a mathematical definition of a gauge transformation. If you ask some mathematician and say what is a consistent way to define a local action of a Lie group on a vector potential, irrespective of the physics, they will tell you, oh, this is your only solution.
So, sorry, is it right that you what do you mean by consistent is the...
By?
What do you mean by consistent is the covariant and derivative transform in the covariant way?
That's what I explained on Friday.
Yes.
Which is that if you have a gauge transformation, if you have a gauge field, well, if you have an object, it can be, mu in fact, transform a bit different. If you take, if you consider a field, for instance, a scalar field, phi, which belongs to the fundamental representation. Or a phi f, which is belongs to the, I'm sorry, adjoint. So this is fundamental, or which belongs to the adjoint representation. Like alpha. Alpha belongs to the adjoint representation. So the covariant derivative. So a field in the adjoint representation behaves like transforms as phi f goes to g times phi f. Phi f is a two vector. A field in the adjoint representation transforms like under a global transformation like G, it transforms like G phi A, G minus 1. So it exists without the derivative. So that's the definition of a non-infinitesimal gauge transformation. Okay? And the point is that the covariant derivative is defined, d mu is such that if you take d mu of phi and make a gauge transformation, so this is, let's call it phi f g, and this phi a g. So you take some field, it can be in the adjoint, it can be in the representation, and apply a gauge transformation of this. It's d mu of phi g. So it commutes with the gauge transformation. You see? And you can check that with this definition of the, well, of the covariant derivative with the definition that we gave, X makes the job. The ordinary derivative, of course, doesn't make the job, because the ordinary derivative will involve derivative of G. Okay, so that's why it's called covariant derivative. And since the action involves only covariant derivative, it's also invariant. Okay. Okay, may I come back to this? Yes?
It's a question related to this itself. So if the group acts on A,
yes,
then it will take all the A's to AG, right?
Yeah, it would get one A to one AG, another A to another AG. Yes.
So, then what exactly is happening? Because all the possible A's in capital A just goes to another AG.
Yeah, I'm going to describe this. So here I consider one AG, but you see, here you have an, if you have some other G, one, G2, AG3, so different gauge transformation, G1, G2, G3, maps A into different AGs. And the set of all these OG is called the orbit of A. So this is the orbit, in fact, this is the orbit of A under the action of G.
And all the possible gauge transformations of A, all the possible AGs,
yes,
will also be in A? Well, they
are in A, because A is a space of all possible gauge configuration. I have put some boundary because I just wanted to represent a big set. But of course, AG has no boundary. Well, A has no boundary. Okay, these are just... okay, but now, of course, another A. If it's not gauge equivalent to this one, so it's not in the orbit, has a different orbit. You see? So A is decomposed into orbits. And each orbit corresponds to one physical configuration of the field. So you have the space of A, you have some orbit of A, and you can denote this orbit of A, G of A. So it's the image of A by the action of G. So let's call this, let's use this denomination. G of A is the image of A, not by a given function, by the set of poles. So it's a cell of all orbits of A. G of A is a set of all A of G, or given A. Okay? I think that's...
To get this set of AG or like AG1,
yes.
AG2,
yes.
Do we use the same element of the group G?
No.
No.
This is the image of A by a given G1. So if I consider G1, it maps A into AG1. A given another G2 maps A into AG2, etc. Okay. Well, this notation, I'm not sure that's what the notation I used it, but that's not very important. Okay. So here I have orbits.
And these orbits will never intersect with each other?
Well, if they intersect, imagine that you have an orbit that two orbits that intersect. That means that this configuration, this point, applying some G element G, this gives, so if I, let me have A, I have A prime, and that is A zero. If I have this, this means that there is a G such that AG equal A zero. Here I have a G prime such that this is A prime of G prime. But you can invert. It's clear that A of G1 of GH is A, is AH of G. We apply a group, so we can compose the element. So, apply ta 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 ta. So, this implies that A is A0 of G minus 1. I apply the inverse, and I go back to element. While A prime, remember, but A0 and A prime is A0 of G prime minus 1. So A is, or if you, A prime is A G prime minus 1 times G. So they belong to the same orbit. If two orbits share one point, they are the same orbit. They cannot do fancy things like that. That's forbidden. Forbidden. Okay. Of course, it's a group. G is a group. So A of GH is AH of G. So we have orbits. And the orbits in the mathematical language makes foliation, the foliation of A. A is made out of some parallel orbits. And this means that in fact, the physical space of physical configuration I'm here thinking in terms of classical configuration but it's going to make sense in the quantum at the quantum level mathematician would tell you this is the quotient space of A by G. So it's a set of orbits. It's a quotient of A by the action of the group G. So we have a set A, a group G that which acts on the set, and the set of critical configuration, that's what we want to consider, is the quotient of A by G, because it's a set of orbits. Okay. So now, let me go back to this picture. Well, let me draw this picture. Then what is a gauge fixing? Why do we need a gauge fixing? We have our big A, we have the sets of slices, the sets of orbits. And choosing a particular point on the orbit shouldn't change the physics. So making a gauge fixing like the one that we wrote here for electromagnetism means simply choose a point, a special point, on each orbit. So gauge fixing means choose a gauge slice, if you want. We choose a slice orthogonal to the set of orbits. Okay. Gauge slice, which means that you see, for each orbit we have a definite you know, configuration A. Which is a representative. So for each slice, for each orbit, we have a representative A in the slice. Okay. This representative will be the A in the orbit which satisfies some gauge condition. You see, so choosing a gauge condition consists in selecting a slice, which is a set of all A that satisfy the gauge condition, and considering only those A, because we know the other ones are equivalent. So this is a picture which is 1 + 1 dimensional, but you should view this as something taking place in is an infinite dimensional space. So the sets of A has some very big dimension. The dimension of the gauge group is also infinite, but much smaller. Otherwise, you could fix, there would be no degrees of freedom. And the orbit has, you know, is orthogonal. So it has co-dimension, the dimension of the gauge group. So its dimension is the dimension of A minus the dimension of G, which both are infinite. But think about it. For finite group and finite sets, that's going to be the same. Okay. So fixing a gauge means choosing a gauge okay, so for instance, if I use a Lorentz gauge, I get this. Yes?
So along that gauge slice, we have just one particular element of G?
Yeah, if it's well chosen, yes. Okay. There are subtleties because it may happen that there are many. But that's, you imagine that you have your gauge slice and it does something like that. It goes like that and then goes down. If you are not careful, and in fact, this happens, but this may happen.
And if that happens, there's going to be overcounting, you know?
You will be still have several gauge equivalent. Yeah, so then you have to work a bit more. Yes?
So it means that you have to fix like again.
Okay, yeah, you have to. Okay, but forget about that. Assume that this is unique. Okay. And it works, for instance, for the axial gauge. For the axial gauge, we are sure that it's okay. For the other things, there might be subtleties. But let's close our eye on that problem. It's a problem that wants appear in perturbation theory. Anyway, okay. And if we do that, we are on safer ground to do perturbation theory, because somewhere here, there is the orbit. This is the orbit of the minimum of the action. So this is the ground state of the theory, the classical ground state of the theory. You see, somewhere we have some A0, where this is zero, typically, where F mu nu equals zero, so the action is zero. So we have that's the classical vacua of the theory. In electromagnetism, the vacua, you have no E, no B. So F mu nu equals zero. That's the same for gauge theories, for non-abelian gauge theories. If the field strengths vanish, there are no fields in space, that's the vacuum. So somewhere, there is a ground state. And if you consider only, you know, gauge configurations that are orthogonal to these orbits, you consider excited states. That's the idea. So this is just a geometrical picture. You know. Fixing a gauge means choosing a representative in each orbit for the gauge field configuration so that we are sure that we are dealing with physically inequivalent field configuration. So that's the idea. And the question is, how can we implement this in the functional integral? Because we know how to integrate over all space by this very big functional integral. How does this big integral reduces to a choice of gauge? And here one has to work a bit more. Yes?
I am kind of confused because I thought that each one of the orbits were like the state of the system at one configuration.
Yes. But it's an history, but yeah, yes, yes, yes. Okay,
yeah,
go on.
It was like all the orbit was one state, and it was like each point of the orbit were related by gauge transformations.
No, the orbit are not related by gauge transformation.
No, I mean like all the points in one
orbit. All the points in the orbits are related by gauge transformation, yes.
So I was thinking that it was just like one state.
Yes.
And then if you go to another other orbit, you're looking at the evolution of the system at certain different points.
No, because that's not true. Because this is a configuration of mu in space-time. So that's an history. That's an history.
In
of the gauge transfiguration.
But it's like in a certain time and in a certain point.
No. It's a value of mu at all point of space and all point of time. So this is already an evolution. This is an evolution of the field configuration with time in space. You see? So among those orbits, some, you know, you have the ground state, which is invariant under translation in space and time. You have the vacuum. You have some orbits which correspond to solution of the equation of motion of the theory, and some which do not. And that's exactly like in Feynman path integral, where you integrate over all the histories. Some histories are solution of the equation of motion, those are classical trajectories, but most of the histories fluctuate around classical equation of motion. They are not solution of the classical equation of motion, but you must take them into account when you quantize the theory, because the quantum theory allows quantum fluctuations. See, because of the uncertainty principle. So there is also an uncertainty principle for gauge field, exactly at the same origin. That's because when doing that, we want to do quantum. If we do classical mechanics, we just need to find which orbit are classical solutions. Here we are fully quantum. It's very schematic, but that's fully quantum. See? Okay, I think it's a good time to stop there. So let's eat in 5 minutes. And we'll go into the deep part.
Huh? Like
yes. So what is your?
You have all the gate surveys.
Yes.
And so you understand all of the classical mechanics one of the orbits, like all the points in one orbit are
yes.
related to gate transformation.
Yes.
We are looking at time t equals one.
No, no, there is no time. Here there is no time. Time is inside this point. The point represents the data of a mu of t and x.
So
time, if you want to, can represent the configuration.
So 1 point here is like...
It's another solution. So we are...
Yeah, here and here we have different solutions, right?
So you can
this is one orbit, this is so my point is like all these states are like physically the same.
Yes, but all those states are physically the same in space time. So for any time we are considered, in other words, you can think about that. When I have write that a gauge transformation is J of X, that's a gauge transformation that depends on time and X. Mm-hmm. So we allow gauge transformation depending both of space and time, which is something which is not always done in electrodynamics.
Yeah, like
here we consider a gauge transformation which depends both of space and time.
But my point is that these and these are going to be different in space and time, but they are physically equivalent.
Yeah.
So they are
the same history. They describe the same history of a field, not necessarily a solution of the equation of motion, but the same history of the gauge field.
So how can we say like that all of these is going to be one of the the orbit of minimum of the action?
That's simple because if you look for the minimum of the action, that's clearly F mu nu equals zero. That's the solution where you have no field, no electromagnetic field in the vacuum. E and B equals zero. Everywhere, at any time and any E of T and X equals zero, and B and T and X equals zero. Okay? So now we know, and therefore this implies that F mu equals zero.
Okay.
Now, well, let's go in U1 theory, for instance, in electromagnetism.
Wait for the record.
A solution of this is A mu equals zero.
How many?
It's A of T and X equals zero. Because if A and T and X equals zero, it's clear that E and B are zero. Okay. But now, any gauge equivalence, any gauge equivalence. So any A such that A of T and X that's A mu. That's A mu. Is D mu alpha of T and X in, with some arbitrary alpha.
Sometimes in the representation.
Here A is not zero. Because you can choose any arbitrary function.
I decided to apply to X.
But still, in electromagnetism, you will have E and B equals zero.
It takes time. Those
Yes, just like my concern is that I remember what we wanted to solve equations of motion.
Yes.
You have to fix the gauge, otherwise you can solve equations.
No, it's
when you fix the gauge,
yes.
You're actually like looking at one solution
yes.
of equations of motion.
Yes.
But then it is written there, it sounds like guaranteed solution is one of the orbits because it says that it's like the minimum of the action.
No. So it means like any point.
characters we don't have.
On the orbit, is a solution of the equation of motion. It's a solution of but it corresponds to the same E and B.
I myself also don't know.
So they are physically completely equivalent.
Sure. Yes, this is what I mean. Now I'm gonna have to scramble.
Like, how you get to choose rather than the meaning, not the
it's always in the battle.
Because they have the same action.
That's what I think.
All this configuration of in space and time of A have the same action by gauge invariance.
But it sounds like if it is a minimum of the action, it means that you can solve the equations.
Yeah, well, they are solved. That's A equals zero.
But I think that when you solve the equations, it's when you actually fix a gauge, and that this is going to be like the minimum of the action.
This is not the minimum of the action, because somewhere you have the minimum action. Here you have another solution, which is not the minimum of the action. It's completely orthogonal. Fixing the gauge, you must fix the gauge without touching, you know, without modifying the equation of motion, otherwise you change the theory.
Oh, yes, I completely agree. Yeah, I got
okay, I'm going to be more specific here, so I can, I should start. No, not 2 minutes, 2 seconds.
Okay, 2 seconds.
Yes.
So, these are like the orbits?
Yes.
At each point, I have mu for all t and all
s. Yes.
So that is a complete solution or not?
No, that's a complete.
In all time.
Yes. I should
all
have been more specific. Yes, yes.
All these sites are related by gauge transformations.
By a time and space
time
dependent
gauge transformation. But they're all equivalent because of the gauge.
Yes.
And because in quantum theory, you want to consider all possible paths.
Yes.
One possible gauge.
Yes.
And if
Okay, so let me start again. So let me repeat once again, because I realize there are many questions, that each point in this space is a history, it's a configuration of AMU everywhere in space and at each moment in time. So that the data of an history of a field configuration in space, like an history of the past. And therefore, when you make a gauge transformation, a gauge transformation is associated to a gauge parameter, for instance, alpha, which depend both on time and x. So you may take a wild gauge transformation when it's written here, where the gauge parameter, the generator of the gauge transformation, can be completely different at different times. You consider everything possible, every gauge configuration possible. And you have to do that because one is doing functional integral quantization. We want to integrate over all the possible histories of the fields configuration. So all the possible configuration of the gauge field in space and time. Okay, so now, how do we do gauge fixing? So gauge fixing means we want to know how we integrate over this slice. And one must be very careful because, in fact, there is a subtlety which is already present in electromagnetism. It means that your choice of gauge is arbitrary. You can take one slice, which corresponds to the Coulomb gauge, one slice, which corresponds to the axial gauge, one slice, which corresponds to the Lorentz gauge. They should give the same result. Okay. And you see that, for instance, like if you take some measure, which is just the projection of the measure on the gauge slice, for different slices, it can give very different results. So we must be careful of which measure on each slice respects gauge invariance, is consistent with gauge invariance. Okay. So the trick to do that.
I just mean
is that choice of difference gauge fixing condition means that we integrate over a different slice. So I integrate over a different space. And the question is which measure of integration, the dA. When you reduce dA to this, you need to do this in a consistent way, not to break gauge invariance. So, and that's what this Feynman, DeWitt, Fadeyev, and Popov procedure is doing. The question is, how do I do that? Okay. And well, the trick for that is write one as an integral. So I'm going to show you, and so I think this might be fit the rest of the lecture, in fact. I'm going to consider a very simple example first, and then I go to integration of a groups, and then I'm going to integration of a gauge field configuration. Okay? So consider that I have the real axis with a variable x, and I want to I choose a point x0, and I want to write the integral over dx of delta of x minus x0. That's one, obviously. That's a Dirac delta function. Dirac delta function. Now imagine that in fact this x0 is given by some equation. We don't know exactly what it is, but imagine that x0 is solution of an equation f of x0 equals 0, where f is some function. This is f. We assume that there is a function. With just one zero, with one solution. Okay. And solving the equation is complicated, but the function is simple. So the question is, can we write this as integral over dx and the delta function of f of x. It might be more convenient to manipulate this equation. Because then, of course, this gives 1 when f of x equals 0. But obviously, this is not the solution. Because f can have a derivative. No. So in fact, the solution is that this is this works if you multiply the delta function over x by the absolute value of the derivative of f. F prime of x is df over dx of x. Okay, that's the rule. Yes?
Isn't f prime of x naught?
No, yeah, no, it's f prime of x naught, but this is zero except when x equals x naught.
Okay.
So you can take this, it works. It's just a rule of change of variables. Change of variables. Change of variables. From x to f. It's a rule of change of variables. Okay. Okay, so this seems very trivial. But that's the clue. Because now, this is for R, so that's for one variable. Now imagine that you have an integral over R to the power n, so n variables. So x is going to be now a vector. You have one point in Rn, x naught, which is given by solution of an equation. So you have a function f of x, which is given by a function f1 up to fn. So each f1, fn are functions of x. We can write this as f1 of x, fn of x. So we have n functions of n variables. Okay? And assume that x naught at a point is just given by f of x naught equals 0. So this gives n equation of n variables. We assume that there is only one solution. Okay? Then we can hope to do the same thing. We change the variables from x, which is a vector, to f, which is another vector. We change n variables into n variables. Can we write 1, which is integral dx, but that's an integral of delta of x minus x naught. Can we write this as integral dx products from 1 to n of delta of f I of x? So a product of delta function for each fi, because this means that fi of x equals 0 for I equal 1 to n. So I have a product of delta function. Well, the same trick works. 1, let me write this here. 1, I can write this as integral dnx, a big delta function of f of x. So delta function of a function of many variables is just a delta function in n dimension for each component. And then I have something that's going to be bad for you. So times, well, it's just generalization of that. That's the absolute value of the determinant of the matrix of partial derivative. So the derivative of df over dx of x, where this is a matrix dfi of x with respect to dxg. So it's an n by n matrix, it's a Jacobian matrix of partial derivative. And we have the absolute value of the Jacobian matrix. So it's just a generalization. So it's a rule of change of variables in n function of n variables. So okay. So now, okay, I think I can erase this. Now, the question is, can we do that for can we do this for a group? Because here we are integrating over the group. And you see the gauge fixing condition here, this is going to be if I want to integrate over the orbit, I want to integrate over the group and found the point which satisfies some equation.
Yeah. That Jacobian matrix element.
Yes.
Should it be small f, del smaller over del xj?
Small f over x.
It should be smaller.
Yeah, it's small f. Here it's a small f. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. In my mind, small f and capital F are written slightly different. If it's a bit curly, it's a small f. Okay, but if you prefer, let's do that. So I write by, you know, this is a shorthand notation. D capital F of a D capital X means the Jacobian matrix of these variables, of the change of variables. Okay. Okay. So, well, the point is that we can do the same thing for an integral of a group. Let's assume that we have a group, a Lie group, like SU2. Oh, I have a group here. This is represent my group. Okay. A Lie group, like SU2, has an invariant measure on this group. So you can integrate over the group with the invariant measure of the group that I call G, which is called the R measure. And for well-behaved group, this R measure is unique, and it's of course in general it's unique, but most importantly, it's group invariant. It means that if you apply a group transformation, d mu of g times g zero, this is the same as d mu of g. It's a measure. So if you, this is your group, imagine that your group is a sphere, but it's, a sphere is not a group, but that's not. If you measure the, you know, the volume of a small element of the group centered at G, and you multiply it either to the left or to the right, if the group is called reducible, that's okay. You get another volume element. The volume element are the same. So that's a property of the R measure. R measure is invariant under the action of the group. Okay. I won't need the exact expression for this R measure, but it exists. You open any book on Lie group and you get it. Okay. And now imagine that somewhere in this group, I have a special element that I call G0, you see, which is such that, so I have an element G0 in the group, which is defined by a solution of some FG0 equals zero, where you have some, I have set of functions of the group, And the solution of f of g, when those function vanishes, so that function from the group onto R, for instance, onto the real numbers, and the zeros of this function is a special G0. Okay? And I want to compute, write one as integral over g, d mu of g, that's the R measure, and the delta function of G and G0. So that's a group invariant Dirac measure. Okay. The Dirac measure on the group. Okay. And the question is, can I write, use the same trick? Well, first you have to think about how many functions do you need. You see, if the group G, like SU2, has n generators, so if the group G has n generators, in fact, F is given by some function FA. where A goes from 1 to n, which is the number of generators of the group. That's the called dimension of the group. Therefore, this is the dimension of its Lie algebra. Okay? And therefore, if you have FA functions, okay, you can write F of the group as FA of the element of the group times TA. So you can make those, for instance, SUT, those three functions, a function on the group into the Lie algebra of G, which is a vector space, by the same trick. This is a function, real number, and you make the combination of them with the generators. Okay. So this is a 2x2 matrix, 2x2 Hermitian traceless matrix. Okay. And then the question is, the question is, can I do the same trick? Is there a generator? Can I write this as, can I write this integral, 1, as integral over the group with d mu of g, a collection of delta function which is delta of f of g, where delta of f of g means products over a of delta of f a of g. What is the analog of the Jacobian, which has to be written here? Well, there is a Jacobian that I'm going to write, which is just, I'm going to write this determinant of f prime of g, where this is the determinant of an n by n matrix. And I'm going to see, so this is, what is f prime of g? This is an n by n matrix, which is defined in the following way. I multiply g by g prime equal g times 1 plus I alpha, with alpha equal alpha a t a. So this is an infinitesimal multiplication by an element of the group. I am a point on the group here, and I move it just by a small amount. Okay. So alpha is an element of the Lie algebra. So each alpha a is just a real number. It's a small real number. Then I may consider what is the function, what is the derivative of each function fa of g when I make a variation like that. So I find g 1 plus I alpha. Okay. And, well, fb, let me write fb because, of course, you have b equation. That's, well, that's my opposite notation. So let me write this was fa, and here I write b. So b goes from 1 to 3. So So let me write this as considering that. So FA of G, when I make this and the variable, G is in fixed, is a function of the alpha, of alphas. So I can compute what this is when I vary with respect to alpha B. You see, so G is fixed. Alpha B, the alpha Bs are, well, the alpha Bs are here. So alpha B are infinitesimal. Infinitesimal variables. So I show how FA of G vary when I change G by a small amount alpha. I take the partial derivative and I take the alpha equals zero at the end. So that's the definition of a derivative of a function with respect to a generator of the Lie algebra. So, so I define this to be dB over FA of G. That's a definition of my notation. So it's just a definition of the partial derivative of the function FA on the group in the direction B. To take it as a definition. And the matrix F prime, which is here, F prime of G, is just the matrix whose matrix element as D F A of G. So that's an n by n matrix with real coefficients. So these are real coefficients, which are functions of G. So these are real functions from the group into R. So F prime is a function, F prime is a function from the group into the set of matrix dimension n on R. And it has a determinant, and you can compute the. So this is a way to write one when you have a constraint on the element of the group and you want to pick up the element G naught. So I have G naught defined by this equation. And I want to pick this element in the group. So it's just a generalization of this very simple fact. And that's the trick which is used to deal with this gauge transformation, gauge fixing procedure. And I still have 5 minutes, so I'm just going to explain the principle. And now, so this is our receptor, and how to write one as an integral. Seemingly trivial things, but not that simple. Okay? So now how can we apply this to enforce the gauge fixing? Well, you have to realize that fixing a gauge, as you have seen here, means enforcing that some function of the gauge field is zero. You see, if you consider, for instance, the Lorentz gauge, it means that the function d mu a mu of a is equal to zero. So it means that we want to fix that. I consider a gauge fixing condition. Gauge fixing condition means simply that I have some function of A, some big function of A, function of A, which is equal to zero. So F is a gauge fixing. Okay, and this functional is, for instance, for the Lorentz gauge, the fact that So it's a functional. So to each point x, and to it's a functional on each generator and each a, you have a function f a of x, which is a functional of the gauge field configuration a, which is that d mu a, I'm sorry, d mu a mu a of x equal to zero. You see. So f here is a functional of x, is a set of configuration. So f is just this family of condition f a of x and a. See, where a is a variable. So a is a field configuration in space-time. So it's a function. You see, from M4 to the Lie algebra of the Lie group. A lives in the adjoint representation. And x and a are the indices. So they play the role of the indices 1n here. So they play the role of I going from 1 to n in when you have a function from Rn to x. So they are the indices. Oh no, A, no, I'm sorry. A is the index, so it's A is the index of the Lie algebra, and X is a space-time indices. So they play the role of that. Okay, so a gauge fixing condition, you can write it in a very compact way as some gauge fixing functional of the gauge configuration equals zero everywhere in space-time. And this gauge functional is a function from A, which send, you know, so this gauge functional is a gauge functional from the space of gauge configuration onto the Lie algebra for any function of x. So it's a function on the Lie algebra times Minkowski space. So it's a function from the space of field configuration into function of space-time into the Lie algebra. Okay. So that's an abstract way to consider what is a Lie algebra. Okay. What is a gauge fixing condition? I think you need to get a bit of gymnastic with that, but it's a very compact notation. It's a set of functions which conditions that f of a equals zero. Okay, and then choosing a gauge fixing condition is to write my functional integral over a here, over a, my big functional integral, over gauge field configuration, and I want to pick up the a's such that f of a equals zero. You see? So I want to pick up, I want to write something like such that f, this delta of capital F of a, equals zero. So I want to have a big Dirac functional delta function. Functional Dirac delta function. But I want to do this without changing the property of the measure. So there will be, I expect there will be some determinant of something. So that this doesn't change what I started from. Okay. This we shall compute. So the question is, can we have something like that which works? How can make this work? And which is this object? This is the Fadiyev Popov determinant. And we are going to see next tomorrow that it's easy to compute, to write. Yes?
What are the terms in the decomposition of curly A as a tensor product?
Oh, no, it's just a way. It's just a way to write that we have this function f is a function from the set of function of A. So A is a set of A mu A of X. So it's a set of functions from Minkowski space into the space of gauge potential, which are vectors times with indices in the Lie algebra, onto a space of condition, into the space of function FA of X, which are functions from M4 into the Lie algebra. Okay, so that's just a mathematical way. You can write that the function from a set to another set are just the formal products of the two sets as an element. But that's, if you are uneasy with that, just forget about it and take this. The gauge fixing condition is a functional from the set of gauge field configuration into the sets of functions from M4 to the Lie algebra. So that's for each x, you have three conditions, Fa of x, that you can rewrite as Fa of x, Ca equal F of x, an element of the Lie algebra with three independent components. It's a 2x2 matrix with three independent components. Okay. And the gauge fixing condition is that you look for the A so that this F of X, which is FA of XTA, vanishes for all value of X. So you look for a specific point where this function is zero. It's a function zero everywhere. It's a constant function, which is zero, equal to zero. This is a functional. This is a function on Minkowski space with value in the Lie algebra, and you want this function to be zero everywhere. This is a function zero. Zero function. See? Okay. Well, okay, it's time to stop there. So tomorrow, I was very ambitious at the beginning of the lectures. Tomorrow we'll show how to compute, well, how to write this Fadiyev Popov determinant. But we have all the tools to do that. Okay, so thank you.